doing spiritual assessment, which is a clinical activity. However, I will say that there are caveats. I do have to modify that. That's something we're happy to talk about. I'd like to provide a little background to the method, describe the core steps of the methodology, provide an example.
Maybe you could speak. Slower, maybe not so well. But.
I'm so sorry. When I know I have a little time,
I think you go fast anyway. But okay.
Only in English. Okay. Thank you. And then I'll provide an example, and I'll discuss application. Okay. Thank you. We go to the next slide. Thank you. Okay, so I'm thankful for the presentation yesterday by George Fichette, in which he presented the challenges of spiritual assessment in today's world, because that saved me having to do that during our time. But what I would like to do is read a quote. It's going to be on two slides by a psychiatrist talking about his work with war veterans. So he's a mental health professional, psychiatrist who works with war veterans, and he's providing a caution about the use of assessment tools. So he writes, healing from trauma depends upon the communalization of the trauma. So before analyzing, before classifying, before thinking, before trying to do anything, we should listen. Categories and classifications play a large role in the institutions of mental health care for veterans, in the education of mental health professionals, and as a tentative guide to perception. All too often, however, our mode of listening deteriorates into intellectual sorting, with a professional grabbing at the veteran's words from the air and sticking them into mental bins. To some degree, that is institutionally and educationally necessary, but listening this way destroys trust. At its worst, our educational systems produce counselors, psychiatrists, psychologists, and therapists, we could add chaplains, spiritual care professionals, who resemble museum goers whose whole experience consists of mentally saying, that's Cubist, that's El Greco, and who never see anything they've looked at. Just listen, say the veterans, when telling mental health professionals what they need to know to work with them. So we could wonder, in the area of spiritual assessment, do we do this? How do we do this? Maybe we say, like, oh, this is a guilty person, or, oh, this is a person who needs this ritual, or, you know, this person needs prayer, and, you know, or this person is, you know, ill in the way that they're lonely and disconnected. But pathologize them. And actually, that's a word I use frequently in my own caution about the field. And so it's been very interesting to me that our speakers have also been using that as a cautionary word. Now, the other side is I'm a very strong advocate for spiritual assessment. So it's really just a caution or a humility that I believe that we need to bring to the task of spiritual assessment and education, and also the research that we do. So in a moment, I'll come to the research method that I find is helpful in being able to engage with this. But I'd like to share a few metaphors for how we can think of ourselves, whether we are researchers seeking to understand our topic, or if we're chaplains seeking to understand the person in front of us whom we've come to care for. So backing up a few millennia, Socrates in Plato's writings describes his role as a teacher as that of a midwife. And he basically states that people have knowledge inside of themselves, and the role of the teacher is to help the person give birth to the knowledge and wisdom. Midwife, it's in birth and childbirth, the nurse who helps, but in a very holistic, like a kind of pre-medical work. So that's his idea. We could think about how would we imagine the chaplain or the spiritual caregiver or the researcher being like a midwife, that we are not there to impart knowledge or to impose knowledge, but we are there to help the person access what he or she already knows. So that's one metaphor. Freud, in some of his early writings, his patient Elizabeth, describes that except in the case of great illness, that he believed in the case, which was her case, that she had the knowledge within herself for what would be the key to her cure. So he saw his role as a psychiatrist, a psychoanalyst, as it's very similar, helping her to come to bring that to consciousness. PHA has really worked on children. You know, we can, for me, thinking about children kind of clarifies this challenge. You know, how do you get into the mind of a child? You know, because a child's perception of the world is so different. And he critiques the methodologies of bringing a survey, because a survey has a list of questions which are constructed from the adult's worldview. And then he also critiques the methodology of pure observation, like, let's say, an anthropologist going into the field and taking field notes, so not engaging directly, but writing notes, because those notes reflect the mentality of the anthropologist. So what Piaget comes to is, he calls a clinical method of research, which is an engagement with, but with an open-ended framework. And I'd say that chaplaincy has generally been very, I think, very good about having that kind of philosophical approach, that we have open-ended questions to help us understand the person in front of us. And just one other note that I always find very helpful, Nancy Ramsey speaks about being co-creators of the spiritual assessment with the patient. So we can apply that to patient care or teaching students, collaborating with the student or with a research. Okay, can we go to the next slide? Thanks. Okay, so the research method I'm going to present falls into the category of what's called discovery research. There's, as you may know already, there's many different kinds of research. We've heard some qualitative references during this conference. We've heard some quantitative, you know, collecting data and doing a statistical analysis. And this form of research, which I'm presenting, that I find so helpful in chaplaincy, is research that seeks to discover something new. So it's especially helpful when looking at a new field, and this is where I thought, like in Israel, where the field of chaplaincy is 10 years old, that it's helpful to think about the kind of research that one might do in a new field, that one wants to be very open to understanding the new field and the new context. It also can be used in an established field to critique assumptions. So I'm going to just give and then also to identify blind spots. So I'm going to give just two examples there from spiritual assessment. So one just from pediatrics. I've used spiritual assessment tools now for a number of years, and when I entered working in pediatrics, I found that there was an item on the pediatric spiritual assessment tools that was absent on the adult ones, and it was the category of safety and security. To what extent did the child feel safe and secure in the hospital? And I thought, wow, this is where adult pastoral care can learn from pediatrics, because isn't it scary as adults as well? But it was interesting for me to think that the other assessment tools kind of had a blind spot on that. Not that it couldn't come up, but it wasn't in the structure. Mindful of my time, not wanting to start speeding up, but let me just quickly share. So the other blind spot came when I worked specifically in the role of Jewish chaplain at a palliative care hospital, and it was a hospital run through the Catholic Archdiocese of New York. And I'd sometimes have the other chaplains or the nursing staff, the doctors, say, you know, there's a Jewish patient in the hospital. And we said, oh, great, we have a rabbi. Should we send the rabbi to you? And they said, no, don't send the rabbi. And then they said, well, we have other chaplains who can pray with you. Do you want a chaplain to pray with you? No. And they said, we don't understand. They wrote down that they were Jewish. So they affirmatively made a statement about their Jewish identity, and yet they've rejected the rabbi, and they've rejected prayer, and they've rejected a chaplain. What does it mean? So I drew on a 20th century Jewish philosopher, Mordecai Kaplan, who stated that Jewish identity manifests itself in three different overlapping realms: belonging, behaving, and believing. And so for me, it was a way to take our very God-centric spiritual assessment tool that we were using at that hospital to expand it. So not that God was absent for Jews or for some Jews, but that category of belonging, that Jewish identity often means belonging for a lot of Jews, I needed a different assessment tool. So anyway, that's where doing discovery research or listening in a spiritual assessment to find something that kind of breaks open the assessment tool is what I'm interested in. And ultimately, I just wanted to bring the 20th century philosopher Emmanuel Levinas, who speaks about encountering the infinity of the other. So he speaks about systems that are totalities are closed. Those are those bins we were hearing about. view of it. And some people would say, you know, maybe, you know, the DSM in psychology, can be used as a tool to open things up, but it also can be used in a negative way to just put people into categories. What if somebody doesn't fit in the category?
Okay,
now we go to the next one. Okay, so here we are. In my graduate work, I've had the opportunity to learn this method called the listening guide. Actually, I guess we'll come to that slide in a moment. But it's called the listening guide method, and it was developed by the developmental psychologist Carol Gilligan and her colleagues. And around 1980, she published this book called In a Different Voice, Psychological Theory and Women's Development. And so what she basically discovered was she was a teaching assistant and research assistant with some of the top psychologists at that time of Lawrence Kohlberg and Eric Erickson. And she was teaching, and then she suddenly had this realization that it wasn't that there was something wrong in those theories, just that they were being presented as if they spoke for all of human psychology, but were based on research with young men in college at Harvard University. And so she said, it's not that it's wrong, but it can't be the whole picture. So again, it was like the idea of a closed system and her wanting to open up the system. It takes a narrative approach, so it's based on some narrative research methods. It's based in psychology. There's an assumption of like the unconscious process in her theory. And I wanted to also point out that it's evidence-based, because sometimes I've found in chaplaincy, we tend to be very deferential, or just in our world today, in our very science-oriented world, to numbers. And that numbers and collecting numerical data is evidence-based, but there are ways to do narrative and qualitative research that are not using numerical calculations that are also evidence-based. So in chaplaincy education, when you do an assessment, you're always supposed to quote where the patient said, like you said, oh, this patient sounds lonely. You're supposed to quote where in the dialogue you got that impression. So it's an evidence-based, narrative evidence-based method. So she starts off asking, she says, the basis of this is curiosity. Just very quickly, for my research, my questions are, so it's a historical study that's also using some qualitative methods. Through probing the story of Jews entering the field of clinical pastoral education, what can we learn about how Jews navigated 20th century America and their own religious leadership? And then also, how do chaplaincy or Jewish chaplaincy students navigate diverse religious and psychological ways of thinking and caregiving during their training? So I don't want to dwell too much on this, but very interested to use the Jewish story to look at broader questions of the interaction between religion and science, and also diversity. You know, we've been hearing a lot about the diverse nature of pastoral care. Okay, can we go on? Okay, so there's three steps in this method, and if you've taken a chaplaincy training course, this will sound familiar, but in the chaplaincy training, it's a case method of education, and so what students do is they write up the dialogue of their visit in a somewhat like a movie script, you know, the chaplain says, the patient says, you know, the nurse enters, you know, like that. But you get, it's called verbatim because it's supposed to be by verbatim, the exact words. If you're doing a research, and that's from memory, so this is one of the differences, because you don't have permission usually in pastoral caregiving to audio record the visit. In research, one would be recording it and would have the interviewee sign a consent form. And then there's basically three steps for using that transcript of the visit. So step one, she calls listening for the plot, and she asks questions. Who is speaking? In what body, telling what story, in what cultural framework, and this emerges out of that in a different voice. And I think that a lot of qualitative research does this step in one form or another, where they're looking for, like, she actually, can we go to the next slide also? So it's the who, what, where, when, why, and how of the person's story. She calls it sometimes the landscape of the respondent's psyche. And it seeks to probe the person's story. And so I think often we see in qualitative research a little bit, like what were the primary themes that the person mentioned? Who were the primary people in their lives? What were the repeating words? Can we go to the next one? And then why don't we go to the next one? It's just saying it in many, many different ways. So I want to give an example from my research. I interviewed a woman who took, a Jewish woman who took CPE in 1972. And in terms of my research, I think she's the first Jewish woman to have taken chaplaincy training. She also happens to be my husband's aunt, which is very interesting. Gives me a lot of access to her and her story, and she was delighted to speak with me. So in my interview, and these are just the references, I begin to hear a theme about being the first, about boundary crossing. So she says, I was invited to work for the first hospice in New Haven. So this was actually when the hospice movement came to the United States. She was invited to be part of that team. Her name's Phyllis. She gave me permission to use her name. She said, she was quoting someone saying, and Phyllis is going to Trinity College, first year girls, which is part of the first year that the school became co-ed. Now she's talking about her supervisor. He told me that I was the first Jew that he knew who did CPE. So that actually wasn't completely true. She was the first Jewish woman, but in her experience, nobody knew of any other Jew taking CPE. And then the final statement here, Hebrew Union College, the Reform Movement's Jewish Reform Movement Seminary, said, and we would love for you to apply and be one of the first women rabbis here at Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion. So what's the significance of all of that? I heard a story from her on the plot level of being the first. This was a theme that just came up over and over again. I'm giving you a somewhat simplified version as the example, but just hold on to that as one theme, that she had a theme of being the first. Okay. Now, can we go to the next slide? Okay. Now we put that aside and we go to listening number two. We go back to the transcript and now we look for something else. And this is called listening for the eye. She metaphorically refers to writing a poem of the I statements as being like a sonogram of the psyche. I'm going to show you how this works. So it's the unconscious logic of the psyche. You know, we all speak. I've been speaking here, you know, this bit of time. I haven't really been paying attention to what kind of I statements I've been making, but we all do it. So you pick up on an associative stream of consciousness carried by a first-person voice cutting across or running through a narrative rather than being contained by the structure of full sentences. Okay, so can we go to the next slide? So here, I'm going to show you now how this works. So this is one of the quotes from the transcript. Phyllis said, when I asked her about becoming compelled her and what inspired her to take the chaplaincy class. She said, but I sometimes felt, I know it sounds so stupid, and I hope it doesn't sound narcissistic, but I really felt a calling. I can't tell you any more than that, but it felt natural to me. Okay, this is the way we speak. And often when we remember things, we harmonize them and we make them coherent. We finish the sentence. This is how we speak. And there's probably ums and ahs in there too. Okay, let's go to the next one. So now I've highlighted the I statements, and now the next one. And now I've made a poem of them. So now we take away all of that other nouns, adjectives, adverbs, and we just have a poem reflecting the I voice as unconsciously expressed. So I felt, I know, I hope, I felt, I can't. There's some debate on how full or simple you make it. So we could read it as, I felt, I know, I hope, I really felt, I can't tell. So there's some discretion you can use, and you can try it multiple ways. And I mean, ultimately what you're trying to do is discover something new that you didn't hear before. Also, if you have negative words and they're like, I never or I don't, you'd put those in as well. So what's interesting to me is that statement that I heard, like stupid, narcissistic, like all of those words, that's what really stood out to me. In this, it's a positive. There are no negatives in here. So that's actually very interesting to me. And then, except at the end. And the ending, in my analysis, I did some more work on that, but I can't tell. It actually is very interesting, you know. It could be, I can't tell you, or it could be, I can't tell, you know, I don't know. But what happens in this is there's a progression, and then it stops. we did a fuller analysis, I'd be able to show you that there was a cadence of starting and stopping in her I poems. And that's very interesting to me because in the plot, it was all about starting. But in the plot, I didn't hear that there was a theme of stopping. Okay, so now, can we get to the next one? Okay, so now, and again, I'm sorry for the just the quick run through this. Listening for contrapuntal voices. So Carol Gilligan, also in her life, is a musician, and she's a pianist, and so she that's also why her language is listening, the listening guide. But in this step, the researcher, or we could say the chaplain also, returns to his or her research question, identifies one can identify and trace relevant voices relevant to the research question. And then I just wanted to say, like, a way to think about this is to imagine listening to the various strands in a piece of music. So you listen to it, put on a piece of music, and you listen just for the flute, you know, or you listen just for the trumpet or the violin or something. And you're first listening for that, and then you listen for another voice, and then ultimately you're looking, you're trying to listen to how the two voices interact. So why this is significant is that a lot of qualitative research methods use what's called coding. And so you code something as A or B, and the actual software can't handle double coding something. So I was thinking, for instance, I was initially curious about her medical side. Could you actually go to the next slide? I can't remember if I put this up. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so it's the same quote. I was thinking, well, can I look at her religious side, her Jewish side, and her scientific or medical side, or psychological side? And it got hard for me because there were some words like narcissistic that clearly comes from the field of psychology. And then there was the word calling that I think fairly clearly comes from the religious realm. But I didn't know how to categorize, like, felt. Is felt, is that a psychological word, or is that a spiritual or religious word? So the listening guide is not looking for A or B, but looking for how there are different voices that might overlap, but ultimately how they interact with each other. Do they harmonize? Do they conflict? Does one overshadow, overpower the other one? Okay, we'll go to the next one. So here's a longer section with that piece, but she says, so now she's talking again about wanting to become a chaplain. She said, I always felt that I must have been scared of death, of dying. I was scared of dying. I was scared of death because dying is so hard sometimes. But I somehow felt, and I just reread the rest earlier, but what I did was I had a voice of starting, so actually I moved away from the medicine and the science and religion to a voice of starting and a voice of stopping. And as you can see, I only came to those voices from the I poems. So I underlined the voice of starting and I bolded the voice of stopping. And then what I could do it takes a while to do, and it's good to do with a class or a mentor, is that I looked at how disruptive this is. You know, that basically she had this voice of stopping that was using science. Now, science doesn't have to be used in a negative way, but the way her mind was doing it was she was using narcissism to, in a way, silence the religious voice, or the voice of calling and the voice of starting. Okay, so can we get to the next one? So, and this is going to bring it to a close. So what this process did for me was it gave me insight into the experience of stopping, and actually Phyllis decided not to pursue chaplaincy. And I think that previously in my research, I was more interested in people coming into the field, and now I had a whole new realm open up for me of what causes people to leave the field of chaplaincy. And that maybe that isn't a failure, but there's something to be learned from it. You know, maybe it's a critique of the field and the educational field. It also helped me revise my research questions. How did or do Jewish CP students and supervisors make decisions about spiritual caregiving? Because here she was facing some big decisions about, do I enter this or don't I enter this? And then, like I said, what contributes to Jews stopping their training? And then, of course, I hope this research just opens up some bigger categories. across the field beyond the Jewish experience. So applications, so I've in some ways I've described the research applications. This method has been used to identify new structures that have then been turned into assessment tools that have then had all that quantitative research done to them. The tools have been tested and then they've been validated. And so there's an example called Silencing the Self about depression. So not in the field of chaplaincy, but just the use of the listening guide. And then for education, I've been talking mostly about verbatim transcripts. But a supervisor, that's the case study of the transcript that the chaplain writes after the visit. But I've also used it with my students' written material. Anything that's in the first person, you can pull out the I's. I sometimes circle them, but if you have students or even in your own writing. I've used psalms and other sacred texts. And then I guess I've already said this. So I think I should conclude, and I don't know how well I stuck to it. Okay, so do we want to take one or two questions or just move on to the next?
It's a very dense and very interesting session. We should put
I don't want to skip
later,
out of time.
So we have the possibility to start this in literally maybe.
Yes.
So we will come to our next presentation. Thank you very much.
So, first of all, I want to thank Michael Pedery, and let's give him a little round of applause for reaching from across the globe to create this course, as this whole conference is, and I'm very honored to be a participant here at Michael's participation. It came out of a trip to Israel that Michael took in the fall, which we met at that occasion, and I think as Dr. Koenig pointed out, the world is exploding with an interest in this field, and I call it the science of holiness. How do we grapple with this struggle, with this wrestling match between medical science, intellectual inquiry, the scientific method, and human spirituality? And this subject seems to have become the world's subject. So I'm not surprised that it's only the fourth European conference. And as he said, there has been more research papers done in the past 4 years than in the last 10 or 12. And I want to just tell you, using two biblical images, and then some history of research, and some Jewish texts, and I've got a chance to do that in about 20 minutes, right? 22,
25.
Okay, 25. So, if there's one biblical text that everybody can relate to, is let's go back to the opening slide. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Just I want to explain to you the origin of this, of what is this Metropolitan Jewish Healthcare System slide, and what is frustration about. I'm going to pass around a binder. This is the research that was conducted that I was a part of, going back to the year 2003. But how did I get here? That's what I want to tell you. Let's start with a biblical image. What is the most powerful image of somebody wrestling with the issue of life and death that you can think of in the Old Testament? Somebody wrestling with life and death, literally wrestling to the point where...
Maybe nearby to a river?
What's that?
Nearby to a river?
Nearby.
Is it wrestling?
Okay. Well, we can go back a little earlier than that to Jacob, who wrestled with the angel of his brother Esau. It should be a familiar text. And he was really wrestling with the angel of death. Jacob had gotten the blessings from his father Isaac. His brother Esau was not so happy about it. Esau was the elder, but he didn't fulfill his spiritual potential. And therefore Jacob, the younger, kind of at his mother, Rebekah's insistence, took his place by getting the blessings of Isaac, who was blind and couldn't tell the difference between the two sons. And Jacob eventually flees the country in the face of his angry brother Esau, who wants to murder him, literally murder him on every level. He builds a family outside the land of Israel, the four matriarchs, right? We have two of the matriarchs that you're familiar with, Rachel and Leah are his wives. Are these names ringing a bell? and comes back, wants to come back to the land of Israel, wants to fulfill his spiritual destiny. This one problem is confronting his brother. And as he enters the boundary of the land of Israel, an angel appears to him in the middle of the night. The angel, which represented the angel of death, the fate that his brother came to decree upon him. Esav was on his way with an army of 400 men to kill him. And that night, a spiritual prelude took place. Jacob spent the night wrestling with the angel of death. The sands beneath their feet went up to the heavens. And finally, Jacob, although wounded, he was wounded in his sciatic nerve, right? He couldn't really walk. Still, he prevailed in the wrestling match. And the angel of Esau, the angel of death, said, "Okay, you win. Now let me go. I'm due in the heavens to sing my praises to God as all angels do." He says, "But I'm not letting you go until you bless me." And he changed his name from Jacob to Israel. And it's not, I think, an accident that the state of the Jewish people is now called Israel. Because certainly Jewish history has pointed out that we as people, we as a nation, have survived through many, many moments of challenge. But when we speak on a human level, we speak about wrestling with the angel of death, our fears, our concerns, the afterlife, our soul, what will be alive. Now, science, on the one hand, represents that challenge to the spirit. And when you're in a hospital setting, your spirituality and your identity, as you struggle with that angel, as you wrestle with that angel, is very important. Israel, then, in this context, represented the ability of Jacob's soul to persevere despite that struggle. So, how did this Jacob get involved? I'll tell you my personal story. I was a congregational rabbi. It's not a job for a nice Jewish boy. But, as in every congregation, pastors, priests, and, you know, there's always a lot of difficulty in dealing with human problems. However, this was my calling. And I became a hospital rabbi. I became a rabbi, and then my local hospital, which helped engineer this research report, asked me to create a program for the Jewish community at large in Long Island. Have you ever heard of Long Island? There's a lot of people there, and a lot of Jewish people there. So I reluctantly said, "But I'm a congregational rabbi. I don't have interest in this. We can go to the first slide. We have other people who deal with people in the healthcare settings. A rabbi will visit his congregant, but then there's a society of people in every Jewish community generally that goes to visit to fulfill what we call a mitzvah." Is that term new to anybody? A mitzvah is a divine command. It's what the Bible teaches us, what our rabbis in the Jewish tradition have taught us over the centuries, is a mitzvah. A mitzvah means a connection to God. And if you want to be godlike, God will inspire you to be kind and to visit the sick. So Jews as a community, as was mentioned by one of the researchers, form organizations within their synagogue, within their community, to do this work. So I said, "You've got plenty of people to do this work." He said, "No, Rabbi, we want you to make a program for us so we know we're doing all the needs." Okay? So I said, "Fine. Now let's go to the next slide." And the question was, how can a healthcare provider like a hospital or a hospice make a program that effectively offers services that enhance the spiritual elements of care? In this case, what I studied was Orthodox Jewish patients, the most observant, the ones who really observe the Jewish law in all of its aspects. Of course, it applies in general to people who see themselves as part of the Jewish faith community on whatever level of observance they're on. So that was the question. Let's go to slide number 2. Okay. So certainly we know healthcare providers want to provide this care. But the question is, what are the challenges? So on the one hand, they can say, "Well, we want the people there to be able to continue their religious practice. And then they will have less anxiety." As we learned with one of our lectures, less expense to the hospital, more customer satisfaction. And I'll give you a vignette as an example. There was a particular man who came in, and this is the scenario. A patient turns dramatically. His wrestling with the angel of death is not going so well. He's declining. The angel seems to be wrestling him out of life. His son is approached by the doctor, who says, you have to sign a DNR, which stands for do not resuscitate. That's the terminology used for advanced directives, what they say in the United States. I was in the United States at the time before I moved to Israel. You have to give us permission to allow your father to die. Now, if you are a spiritual person, what do you think might be a way, right, that you might think about it differently? Say, well, do you want your father to die at this time? Is that what's God's will for him? Maybe I should pray. Maybe there'll be a miracle. Maybe I'll feel guilty of taking his life if I sign this piece of paper. A lot of concerns come up. So in this family in particular, the doctor says, please sign the DNI. This is futile. You'll have to sign it. The daughter said, no, I'm going to pray, and then he'll get better. And she tells her brother, extend his life because we're going to expect a miracle. We're going to win the wrestling match. We're not going to lose. And then the mother says, why should we, here's a Yiddish word I'll teach you, probably have it in German, mutcher. I don't know what it means in German, but in Yiddish it means cause him to suffer needlessly. The mother's saying, why are you putting father through this? The sister's saying, I will not let go of my father. I'm going to pray. The son doesn't know what to do. He doesn't want to violate his... He doesn't even know what his rabbi would tell him to do. And he's in the hospital. They give him the pen. And he's in a dilemma. So to study how to deal with this, we started a research study. But what I want to precede is that I wanted to study this for a reason. I wanted to help I called him Mr. Plony, which means every man in Hebrew. I wanted to study him because I was one. Because summer of 1999, I was then a community rabbi and just starting to be a hospital rabbi. My first wife passed away of cancer, and I was with her the last 3 or 4 weeks in a hospital out in California. And I saw what it meant to have supportive community around me. A Jewish community from Berkeley, California, came to my rescue, visited me, offered me companionship, studied with me, Sabbath food, you know, we're kosher, so they brought us kosher food to the hospital, and I lived in the hospital for 2.5 weeks until she passed away. And when she passed away, it wasn't just a passing, it was a very spiritual experience. We were surrounded by people who loved us, and we literally felt the soul going up. And I'll tell you how I knew. Because we were so upset and crying in the last moments, but a few hours before she passed away, we got a burst of energy. All the tears dried up. We became very happy and enthusiastic. We're going to win the wrestling match. The wrestling match is not over. And then a few hours later, she passed away. And what I understood at that point, which has been why I came to this calling, is that I believe that the holiness, the divine spirit actually kind of came down and lifted her soul. But we were there. So that place, that holiness that we experienced, there's no crying, there's no tears. There's energy, enthusiasm, and life. We touched this essence of life who gives us life, which is God. So I wanted to help others as I was helped. So this is where our research began. Where did it take us? Well, one of the things we realized, and we published an article published in the Journal of Jewish Aging, which I'll pass around, was that people just need to communicate. The doctor needs to talk differently to this Mr. Plony, to take into account what the mother is saying, to take into account what he wants, what guidance his religion may offer him. And we have many different voices, as you spoke about voices, but they're not being heard. So we developed a model which is called the LEARN model, L-E-A-R-N. Just borrow for a second to read you what it stands for. And what we came up with the conclusion was that we have to be able to learn to teach people how to listen, the medical professionals, the nurses, the professional staff. They have to listen to who their people are and tune into their needs, not just shove a DNR paper in front of them and say, this is my system, this is my values. Now, a lot of the doctors and the nurses believe in only one concept, which is quality of life That is the driving force in medical ethics. If a person is disabled, if a person is attached to a respirator, what sort of quality of life do they have? Will they ever visit their grandchildren again? Will they ever be able to go to their daughter's bat mitzvah? Will they ever be able to attend their daughter's wedding? Their granddaughter's wedding? No. It's over for that. So there's no quality of life. What's the point, as the mother of this patient said, to make them suffer? This is the common theme in all of the standard medical establishments, certainly in the United States, which are most familiar, but I think even more so in Europe, and particularly in the Scandinavian countries, where they allow people even to take their own lives under certain circumstances if they deem that their quality of life is not something that they longer is not there for them and they no longer desire to live. But on the counterbalance, there's a value that our tradition brings, which is the biblical tradition, which is the tradition of faith, that there's something called sanctity of life, kedushat chayim. So not only is a human being a person who enjoys life and wants quality of life, but we introduce by this model a different factor, which is sanctity of life. The Jewish tradition and Jewish law, for example, I'll give you one simple example, might say the following, and it's a case-by-case study. If you would ask the rabbi, the expert, they would say, okay, a person is dying of terminal cancer. Let's say pancreatic cancer, right? And now they've reached, you know, the end stage. And they want to be transferred to hospice. And they develop an infection, like a pneumonia. Do you give them penicillin, yes or no? What would you say? Would you?
I am not qualified to answer that. That's a
question. What would the hospice, if a hospice patient, such as that with an advanced illness?
Yeah, because always the person died for a reason. Maybe the heart stopped to work, maybe some, I don't know. It's not. Always we have a reason, body reason.
Right.
So the doctor say, why you would like to take this medicine?
Right, so you're saying, what's the difference?
Yeah.
Mazeh mashana. What's the difference if he dies because of an infection or the terminal illness? What's the difference whether they die because of the cancer or because of the lack of nutrition and hydration? Meaning they don't get fed. But does it matter? I'm helping them. Aren't I not helping them by terminating their suffering? Here's an example of where the concept of sanctity of life would offer a different perspective. They would say, and some of our greatest rabbis in the past generation, who get medical questions from people who care about Jewish law, which Jewish law is called halacha, H-A-L-A-C-H-A, halacha. It's, you know, we hear it more like in now that the Islamic faith has become so well known worldwide. They have something they call Sharia, right? Sharia law. It tells them what to do. It tells them how to conduct themselves, how they want their people to dress, how they want them to behave, how they want them to do business. For example, lending money without interest, which is a biblical value. But we have halakha. I'd like to think that it's 2,000-year-old tradition, which is studied every day in Jewish seminaries around the world, the Talmud and the Mishnah, the Jewish codes of law. And the greatest rabbis, meaning who have proven to be the greatest scholars because people ask them the questions. Like you only go to somebody, how do you know they're the greatest scholar in generation? Not because they got a PhD. It's because people rely on them and they know that they carry the spirit of the law with them and they seem to be more expert than anybody else. So some of the greatest rabbis made the distinction between nutrition and hydration and medication versus terminal illness. They would say something like this. Let's look at that patient. If they could live for a period of time, maybe 3 months, maybe 6 months, but right now they have an infection that would take their life now. Treat it. Give the penicillin. And don't take away the water and the food, because it's not up to us to decide when their life ends. Let's give them what a human being needs to live. Of course, if they have a terminal illness, we're not saying that they have to go through chemotherapy and operations and stay on ventilators. No, That's called prolonging death. We're not interested in prolonging death. The halakha is against prolonging death. You have many cases in the Talmud that describe this. But what they are interested in is prolonging life. And that's a very, very strong value that's rooted in the Jewish tradition. Prolong life. We even set aside the holiest day, Yom Kippur. What do you not do on Yom Kippur? Does everybody know what you don't do on Yom Kippur? You're supposed to fast and repent. So you're not supposed to eat. That's the holiest day of the year. It says it in the Bible. No. If a person is sick, they eat. They must eat. And they make the blessings and they eat as much as they absolutely need to. Why? Because life is more important than any one particular mitzvah. Right? In a general sense. There are some exceptions, but in a general sense. So, to an individual anyway. And therefore, why not let the patient live a few more months? Why not let them live? Maybe they won't have quality of life, but the sanctity of life, that's God's decision how much it needs to be. So that's an example of quality of life versus how do you communicate that? To a doctor that doesn't want to hear it. To a social worker that's not interested. To a family member that has a different view. And all of a sudden there are other people who say, no, maybe it is worthwhile. Maybe I do want to do it. But what happens is, if there's no communication, then they might decide, for example, to give food and water in a way that endangers the life. Everybody knows that towards the end of life, the body kind of shuts down and doesn't have the ability to hold liquids. You could actually drown a person by giving them liquids at that point. Is that a Jewish value of prolonging life? No, you're actually shortening life. So unless you have the medical doctor talking to the religious advisor who can assure the family that they're doing the right thing, you're going to have a potential disaster. Not only will the family not be happy, but the patient will suffer needlessly. And the hospital will incur expenses that were never needed. And the doctors won't be stuck in an ethical dilemma to treat fetal care. So this LEARN model was designed to get everybody literally on the same page. LEARN is listen. E is evaluate the data. Let's understand exactly what the medical situation today is, not last week, and not 2 months ago, today. 3, ask questions to the right experts. You have everybody together in a conference. Doctors, the family, the rabbinic advisor, the chaplains, the social workers, the nursing staff, the administration of the hospital. Who's got to pay for all this, right? Sit down and have a meeting. Meet for 15 minutes. And you know you have to be skilled to get everybody on board and then to make a decision. And then finally, R, reach consensus. And N, negotiate a plan of action. So LEARN is listen. E is evaluate. A, ask questions from the people who have the information. R, reach consensus. And N, negotiate a plan of action. This was the model that we created to avoid the unnecessary suffering and the violation of the holiness of life, which is what people actually were hoping to avoid. How much time do I have? So let me finish with something.
Yes.
Okay, so I want to finish with another biblical metaphor and a story. Okay, so give me 5 minutes. What is the most important biblical image about healing? Well, I don't know about you, but in the United States or in many countries, there's a Mount Carmel hospital here in Malta. I don't know if you noticed that. But if you go, many, many hospitals are named after a mountain from the Bible, which is called Mount Sinai. Manhattan, Mount Sinai Hospital, Cedars Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles, all of it. Mount Sinai, what does that have to do with the hospital? Mount Sinai was the place where Moses got the Ten Commandments. What does it have to do with anything? So we can understand better that when people stood at the foot of Sinai and encountered God, just as Moses had seen the burning bush on that same place, the fire was burning the bush on Mount Sinai, but it wasn't consumed. Similarly, people can have all sorts of illness, but with God's Spirit, they can survive. They can stay there, in that place, whole. They can reach a wholeness. When you're connected to the Divine Spirit, there's healing. There's a possibility of life. As we heard, as Dr. Kenning said to us, all the studies well, who was it yesterday? All the studies that showed that if there is some hope in spirituality, the prognosis for life, that's what gives the bush the ability not to burn. Sinai, the energy of God. Now, I'm going to read you, I'm going to end with a story, because Jewish tradition needs those, we to keep that fire burning, you need inspiration. It just doesn't come by itself. So in the last 200 years, I would say 250 years, there's been a movement within Judaism known as Hasidism. Hasid, do you ever see a Hasid? Those are the guys with the long things like this, right, with the long peyote, that everybody thinks that's the only Jew. Well, that's a new type of Jew that came to the world in about the year 1700. And they wanted to have a passionate connection to God. And the Baal Shem Tov was the first teacher. That was his name. But I'm going to give you a name that I think is a rabbi from that movement whose writings have such a rich material. They all do. But this one in particular, about healing, psychology, and spirituality. His name is Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. And I'm going to give you a tool that you can all walk away with very much. Everybody likes to say Psalms, right? Psalms is long. It's 150 Psalms. You know how long it takes to say the whole book of Psalms? Especially if you're in the bedside, it takes a long time. Or even your daily prayer. I'm going to tell you the 10 most important Psalms that if you say them together, said Rabbi Nachman, you get the whole power of the healing power of Psalms in one little package. It takes 10 minutes. Would you like to know which Psalms they are? Here you go. 16, 32, sounds like a bingo game. 16, 32, 41, 42, okay, 59, 77, 90, 137, no, yeah, 90, 137, no, 90, 105, excuse me, 90, 105, 137, 100. There. If you learn nothing else, you'll say, this rabbi taught me how to take that whole book of Psalms, and those 10 Psalms represent 10 different types of spiritual song that can heal your spirit.
Can you say this? Repeat
the list.
It after 77?
Yes, I'm going to repeat the. I think of them in pairs. First one is
16,
32. 41, 42. Okay? 59, 77. 90, 105. 137 and 150, the last psalm. If you want, I'll repeat that to you after the class. So he's called the Tikkun Klali, the general remedy. He says this is medicine for the soul. Medicine for the soul.
Tikkun
Klali. This is called the general remedy. It heals, it's what we call a spiritual antidepressant. It is the Zoloft of prayer. I'm going to leave you with a story. So this is a story from Rabbi Nachman. He taught with stories that were good for all mankind. Look up Rabbi Nachman's tales. Here's one story. This goes back to the struggle between two sides. There was a king. And the king said, no one has more worries than me. And he went to his kingdom and he was very happy to find out. He listened into every window and he says, oh, he's worried about dying, and he's worried about money, and he's worried about a child, and he's worried about marital problems. Everybody had problems. The king was very, very happy, except he went to one house, a broken down little house, where there's a man inside fiddling away, eating a feast of wine and a fine steak, and he was the happiest man in the world. And the king was jealous. He says, why is this man so happy? He's happier than me. And so he devised a plot to try to get this man to be not happy, so he could be the happiest man. And he said, what do you do? He says, he didn't know he was the king. He disguised himself. He says, I'm a fixer. I can fix anything. I can fix a toaster. I can fix an oven. I can fix a car. Every day I go out, I fix something. I get a few coins. I buy a fine steak, a bottle of wine. I fiddle the night away, and I'm the happiest guy in the world. The king says, okay, I'm going to fix this guy. He makes a law. No one's allowed to fix anything in my kingdom. The guy goes out the next day for work. There's nothing to fix. No problem. He sees a barn that's filled with manure. He says, listen, I'll do it for you. You give me 2 coins. I'll clean up the dirt for you. Great. Cleans out 3 barns. Goes, buys his bottle of wine. Buys a nice steak. Filet mignon. And then he goes to his house and fiddles the night away. The king's checking every night. Goes, this guy's still happier than me. Next day he said, a rule. You have to shovel your own manure. No one is allowed to hire anybody. And so it went until he was forced to join the army because there was no other job. And he got he got permission to go home every night and make a feast. And then they said, no, the king found out, says you're going to get paid once a month. He's got no money for the feast. What can he do? So he took his sword and he pawned it. And he put a wooden blade instead of the metal sword, and he got money for his sword, and he would go home at night. But no one knew that he didn't have his sword anymore until the king found out. He says, now I've got him. They got together the next day, and he says, there's a man who needs to be executed. He says to the fixer, cut off his head with your sword. He's framed, right? He's going to be shot. So he says, no, king, listen, maybe he's innocent. Maybe he's a good person. Why do you want to do this? He says, no, I demand that you do it. He says, okay, but if he's innocent, then God should make a miracle and my blade should turn into wood. Pulls out his sword, it's wood. Everybody started to laugh, and that was it. In my understanding, this is a story you can use for many things, and I'll pass around the story, but in the health metaphor, it's this. The patient, the person wants to maintain his happiness, his sense of self, his sense of security. The system, the king, the problems, life can rob us of that. Our job is to not give up. He says, I can fix anything. The resiliency to stay, to use your faith and spirit to continue wrestling, to be the bush that's not consumed. And I believe that's our job. Science and holiness. We have to use our minds, but we have to maintain our reservoir of holiness, and we have to find it whichever we can. It's a pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you.
Thank you.